think it's just... Okay. Tonight it's my pleasure to welcome Michelle Mira, storyteller, and Daniel Kelly, guitarist, who will be both of whom will be performing on the theme of the mysticism of Robin Hood. Michelle Mira uses storytelling as a method to heal emotional woundings. Daniel Kelly is a talented musician, improviser, and composer, and they will collaborate together. I've been asked to begin the evening by ringing the bell once again for 2 minutes for a brief meditation, and we'll signal the end of the meditation by another strike of the bell. Welcome, Michelle and Daniel.
Thanks, Rob. Daniel and I have had a lot of fun putting this together for you. Mm-hmm. He's put together some wonderful music, and it's really helped me bring the stories out of Robin Hood. I'm going to apologize. There was a slight misprint when we wrote it up. We thought we were going to be reading from the book, but the stories have kind of absorbed themselves into the process, so I'll be telling you the stories now. It's a little bit more fluid that way. You know, we've been working on this for several weeks, and I've been having thoughts about why do these teaching legends come to us? You know, they're so strong. We get the King Arthur stories, and we get Robin Hood, and they're such evocative images of leaders for us. I look at King Arthur, I look at him pulling the sword out of the stone, and it's like I'm invincible, you know, I can do anything. So I began to wonder, what are some of the stories that Robin Hood is telling us about leadership, about what it's like to be in charge of men's lives or in charge of their ideas? And I look at my own fairy tales that I've written, and they were kind of short-term, you know, like building a garden shed out back that you think might last 5 years, and 20 years later it's still out there and you're still putting your tools in it. My fairy tales, I'm not planning on handing down 15 generations. So these stories have been with us for over 1,000 years. It's a really long time. So this teaching story really wants to stay with us and really wants to keep giving us ideas. So anyway, I invite you to think about that while we go through it. Daniel's going to start us. We'll start with the tale of Little John meeting Robin Hood. Little John went walking through the woods one day. It was a beautiful day. May morning, he was in a happy mood. He had his trusty quarterstaff by his side, and he could do no wrong. This was his day. He came to an opening in the woods, and there was a brook. And across the brook lay a great log that was used as a bridge by many people. Just as Little John got to that log, a man appeared from the other side. And they both stepped onto the log at the same time. Little John said, "Let me pass, stranger, for I have the right of way here. It's my day." The man at the other side looked at him and said, "This is my forest. What are you talking about? Get off my log." Little John said, "I think not. My quarterstaff here is the match of any man." The man at the other side very casually drew the bow and arrow, the bow off his shoulder, and strung it, and pulled an arrow from his back, and notched it, and said, "My arrow here says you'll get off the bridge." The tall man at the other end replied, "Well, that's not fair. I won't have a chance to walk away from this. I think one of us should have a chance and opportunity to win this, and the other at least to walk away." Robin looked at him for a moment and said, "All right. It's not fair play, you're right." And he unstrung his bow and put the arrow back. "I'll cut a quarterstaff." And he went to a nearby oak tree and cut himself a quarterstaff with his trusty sword. Now Robin had been looking at this fellow at the other end of the bridge, and he knew he was in trouble because the guy was at least half as tall as he was. But there was no hope for it. He'd already bullied his way into a fight, so he trimmed the little branches off the tree. Took a good long time doing it, but eventually he got back up on the bridge. They stood and looked at each other for a moment. Then Robin did the only thing he could think of to do, which was start twirling his quarterstaff around his head as fast as he could to confuse the man at the other side. Little John, startled, watched him. And then Robin suddenly attacked, actually breaking through and hitting the man on the shoulder. So Little John put up a fight. He started parrying and hitting back. And soon enough, fast and furious, they were into the battle. The sound of blows and thwacks, cuts and thrusts, grunts came floating out across the forest until all that could be heard was the din from these two fighting over that log of a bridge. Finally, after an hour of fighting, Robin pulled back and said, "Stranger, hold for a minute. I must at least get a drink of water." The sweat pouring down his face, both of them covered with bruises from being struck so many times. They both paused to take a look at this stranger who stood before him, strong enough to fight back. Robin took a dip out of the stream while the stranger pulled back and mopped his brow. Said, "I like not the way you fight. You're almost as good as I am." Robin said, "Well, I think you sent your sister in to fight for you, because certainly you're not beating me as much as I thought you would." The big man, John Little, took one quick whack at him for that remark, and it was all Robin could do to put up his quarterstaff to protect himself. The man beat him so furiously that in seconds his quarterstaff, that recently cut small tree, was splintered into pieces of wood, Robin staggering backwards and falling into the creek with a splash. The stranger stood on the bridge, laughing at Robin, and said, "How do you now, stranger?" Robin looked up and said, "In faith, I'm in the brook and floating out with the tide." The tall man laughed heartily as Robin pulled himself out of the creek, sat on the edge of the stream, and Putting two fingers to his mouth, he blew out a shrill whistle. And along came his men running out of the woods to champion him should he need it. They looked at Robin and started laughing. One of them said, "Master, you look like a drowned rat." Robin said, "In faith, I've been beaten by the better man." They said, "Master, shall we douse him in the brook for you?" Robin said, no, it was a fair fight and a good one. He beat me." He said, "Stranger, I'd like to know your name." And so John said, "My name is John Little, they call me." Robin laughed at that, said, "No one would call you little in this man." And he offered him to be Robin's good right-hand man for 3 suits of Sherwood green, 3 green outfits, and a fair take in all that they should win from various people passing through the forest, all the venison he could eat, and casks of strong ale. Little John looked at Robin Hood and said, "I'll take you up on your offer. One thing only, show me a man who can better my archery." Robin Hood said, "Well, we'll try," and placed a wand no thicker than a man's thumb at 50 paces. So John Little chose a bow, and he took a shot at that tiny little marker and notched it right through the middle with his arrow. And Robin Hood looked at that shot and said, "Well, I'll try to match it." And he took his own strong, straight arrow, put it to his bow, and shot it off. His men held their breath, and the arrow split right through the middle of the other man's arrow. His men laughed and shouted out, and John Little came up to him and shook him by the hand and said, "I'm glad to call you master, any man who can better my shot." So the men went into the forest laughing and shouting heartily, happy to have such a good man as John Little in their company. Many times that night, Robin retold the story of how John Little beat him on the bridge in such a fast and furious fight. And the men welcomed him heartily to the forest, where they christened him Little John and poured a cask of stout ale over his head. And that's the story of how Little John came to Sherwood Forest. There's kind of a continuity of themes as we're reading through them, looking for good stories. You know, this guy just doesn't get it. He just challenges everyone to a fight. So the next story we'll tell is of Will Scarlet, who also became one of Robin Hood's closest companions in the forest. Not too long from then, the nearby baron decided he wanted young Will Gamwell's estates and bribed the to Stuart to kill Will, so that one day Will found himself in the forest hunting for the family, only to see an arrow pointed directly at his own heart. Stepping swiftly behind a tree, Will notched an arrow of his own and turned around to let loose at the stranger who had shot at him, only to find, when he went to look at the person, that it was indeed the family steward. This betrayal struck so close to Will's heart, first the loss of his father, and then the family steward selling him out for a few pieces of gold. He pulled the arrow out of the man's heart, stuck it back in his quiver, wrapped his cloak around him, and the only thing he could think of to do was to head off to Sherwood Forest, where his uncle, Robin Hood, had his band of merry men, the outlaws from England. So Robin set off, a good 2 days' walk to Sherwood from his home. The roads were dusty, and then it rained, and then it stormed. It was a bitter, bitter walk. And by the end of it, after 2 days, he was so glad to reach the forest, all he could do was curl up against the trunk of a tree. He pulled himself in tightly to his cape for warmth that night, thinking drearily of the loss of his father, and curled into himself to sob himself to sleep. To have a few burghers stop by to drop off their purses for the men of the forest. So Robin was hunting for deer to be sure to feed their guests. Suddenly spying a bright scarlet note amongst the dark green of the trees, Robin pointed his men to continue on with their hunting, and he went to investigate. Finding a young man asleep against the trees, Robin took the flat of his sword and tapped the man on the backside. "Oh, now, wake up, young man. What do you hear?" Will Gamwell looked up, suddenly, startled out of sleep, to find a stranger with a long sword pointed at him, and jumped up hastily, throwing off his cloak so he could reach his own sword. "I'm passing through. Out of my way, varlet." Robin stepped back a bit as Will Gamwell flashed out his sword. Suddenly, Robin found himself parrying a stroke that he hadn't expected, and the fight was on. Robin had all he could do to fend off the angry young man. All of the angels of hell couldn't hold back Will Gamwell's anger at this moment to be parted from the possibility of meeting his uncle Robin Hood so near after so many days on the road. He fought fast and furious, and it was all Robin could do to block every blow and keep himself from being bloodied. The young man was furious. Robin every once in a while would get in a stroke as fast as he could, but most often he was in retreat, or at least standing still. Eventually, Robin broke through the young man's guard after a good 30 minutes of the clashing din of steel on steel in the forest. Robin thwacked the young man on the back to catch his attention. This only redoubled the young man's fury, and he thrust at Robin so hard he cut through his guard and slapped him on the side of the cheek with a slice that sent Robin staggering backward. Dropping his sword, he tripped over a tree root and fell to the ground. "Hold, young man," as Will Gamwell came to him with his sword. Robin said, "Who are you that you're in this forest so early in the morning?" And Will said, "I'm Will Gamwell. I'm looking for my uncle Robin Hood." And Robin said, "Well, then you found him and nearly killed him." Young Will Gamwell said, "You can't be my uncle." And he reached down to pull Robin Hood up and gave him the embrace of kinship. Robin kissed him on both cheeks and said, "Well, you're welcome here, lad. Any man who can best me in swordplay is more than welcome to be one of my merry men. You shall have a new suit of Lincoln green to replace those bright red hosen of yours, and we'll bring you into the forest and feast you fine venison and good wine and strong ale. What do you say to that?" And the young man nearly wept with gratitude. Robin put two fingers to his lips and blew out a shrill whistle, which brought his merry men running to come and check and make sure their master was okay, for by now they'd surely heard the din in the forest. Little John came running up when he saw the blood running on Robin Hood's face. He said, "Master, do you want me to stab him for you?" And Robin Hood said, "No, no, this is my nephew, my own sister's son. Will Gamwell, come to join us." And as they walked through the forest to the great trysting place that the mighty oak at the center of Sherwood Forest was, they heard Will Gamwell's sad story of losing his father and how the trusty steward had lost faith with the farm, and how much in need he was of this family in Sherwood Forest. And the trees rang with laughter that night as the merry men welcomed him into this new family where he felt so loved and so at home among kindred spirits. And they christened him with a cask of strong ale over his head and called him Will Scarlet. For from now on he'd be wearing Lincoln green, but his scarlet bosom would be long remembered. And that's the story of Will Scarlet.
The timer?
6. Okay. That's good. We'll do the third one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did anybody want to, like, give any comments about the stories, or?
Has anyone had any ideas about Robin's ideas of leadership?
Beat the hell out of him.
I don't know about that, though.
I was really impressed that there seemed to be envy and, you know, kind of bitterness. They actually appreciated who had the best skill. That was the question, not I'm going to get him. Or he, you know, wasn't. It was above the personal animosity that you would usually find.
Yeah, you know, the author makes this great note. He says, "Nearly always when gaining a stout fellow for his band, Robin Hood got a sound beating at the same time. But he never changed his brave demeanor nor ceased to try each man in hand-to-hand combat." And I'll say he never ceased to lose his humor. He always seemed to maintain it. And it's in all the books I read. I mean, we read 3 or 4 before coming into this. And he tried each man in hand-to-hand combat to prove their worthiness to join the band. You know, I noticed that they never, because they'd beaten the master, who could beat anyone at longbow, they never had to fight with the men who were outlaws in the forest after that. So he gained other leaders as helpers for his role, who then didn't have to continuously prove themselves to the men. That was rather remarkable. Anyway. There's some fun stories in here. We'll do one that's along the more traditional lines of Robin redistributing wealth. Robin Hood went walking one morning. He'd heard news that the king was dead and wanted to hear more of what was going on the roads between Nottingham Town and Chester. He was dressed as a monk this day, for he decided it was time to rob someone of all their fine coinage so he could continue himself in meat and drink for the end of the year. He sat down on a log eventually, and 3 young women passed him, called out a greeting to him. "Benedicte," he said, and find some fat burger or a wealthy priest, a bishop, someone with some coins in their pocket to make his year more profitable. Soon along came two priests riding on a mare, singing a happy song. Robin put his hand on the bridle of the mare and said, "Hold, friends, brothers, for I haven't had a bite to eat this day, and I invite you to give me a coin, one single groat, so that I may have food for the morning." They looked at him and said, "Why, no, fellow, we were just robbed not half mile hence by a man looking much like yourself." Robin said, "Surely not, for I'm the only man I know hereabouts who looks like me, and is dressed as a monk as I am." Suddenly they started trembling. They had a fear. Could this be the famed outlaw? He reached up and told them, "Please, spare me some of your wealth so that I may have food for the day." They said, "No, no, surely we were robbed of all we had." He reached up and grabbed them by the cowls and dragged both of them off the horse and invited them to pray with him for a while. He said, "Pray hard that you have money in your pocket." They got on their knees and they prayed quite strenuously. As a matter of fact, sweat started pouring out of their brows. They were praying so hard. He said, "Pray harder." And while they prayed, he hummed a merry tune. Eventually, he said, "That's enough praying. Show me your pockets. What have you to show for all your prayer?" They turned out their pockets and both were empty. He said, "Well, I guess we'll just have to search each other and see if any of us has gotten any wealth from all your prayer. Me first, I'll search you." And he reached into their pockets, and each one of them was carrying a fat and heavy purse. He poured out all the coins, and together it was 500 golden coins. He said, "My, our prayers have been answered well. And for all of your hearty praying, you shall be rewarded." So he put 50 golden coins back into each pouch and handed them to each of the priests. Now they looked a little concerned at this, but not half as concerned at the thought of losing their life. So they were content. They started to go away mumbling. Robin let them go about 2 feet before he stopped them and said, "Brothers, one more thing. I want you down on your knees one more time, and I want you to take 3 great oaths for me. The first is that you will tell no lies. The second is that you will care for the poor and unfortunate. And the third, you'll tell it about that you met a holy friar who lived simply, who took from those who had, and gave to those who had not." Shaking, stammering, trembling, they took this oath. And then he let them go on their way. For he had the money he'd been looking for, and was well rewarded with the sight of their suddenly improved piety. He made sure they got up on their horse and slapped it on the backside with the broadside of his sword, and sent them on their way. While he went away singing a merry tune and jingling the coins in the purse, as he walked back through the green forest to the mighty oak at the center of Sherwood Forest, where the men called out with great joy at the sight of their leader with all of this money for their year, certainly to cover the cost of strong drink and meat for the year. There was a great deal of laughter and feasting that night, for several other burgers had been tossed along the way by other members of the merry band. The men all sang out and shouted, and indeed one of them had been invited as a guest, and so he was regaled as he was dressed in fool's clothes for the evening, and then allowed to go home afterwards. But these feasts of the merry men of Robin, these were the sort of things that drew them all together, that and the kindred spirit they had, not loving the way the land was being run, and holding that their own band was a more true form of freedom. Thus lived the lives of Robin and his merry men, Forester Sherwood. about this guy. I mean, he's an outlaw. And we all think he's a hero, right? But does anyone have any feelings about this? Or ideas about just what sort of thing it takes to create a man who lives his life this way?
What do you draw from this?
I'm not sure. That's why I wanted to ask the question.
I wonder what started him on that path. You know, how he came to it.
Well, you know, the stories say when he was 15, the same thing basically happened to him that happened to Will Gamwell. He inherited his father's lands. And he was ousted by a local baron who wanted the property. He was busy protecting someone and shot someone, and the sheriff's men were after him at the tender age of 15.
What about his parents?
Well, his dad had just died, so he'd inherited the property. And, you know, women were still chattel in those days, so mom can help and love, but that's about it. She goes back to being property of the estate, which is kind of an interesting thought.
The thing you get from his battles was that he was his own man, well at ease. He knew who he was, so he could be gracious to the people that bested him.
Wasn't that amazing?
It was.
Some say there was even a castle at the heart of the forest that they found ruins in the heart of Sherwood. I thought that was interesting.
You do kind of wonder where they slept at night.
You hear about green leafy bowers, but I've tried them before, and I'll tell you, not in the middle of winter.
I'd forgotten how important he was to me as a child. So I'm going to linger over that remembering.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking, too. I mean, he was tremendously important, he and King Arthur. Thanks.
There was a series on Showtime, Robin Hood. I don't know.
Oh, was there really?
Robin of Sherwood or something like that. And Michael Praed was the actor who played him.
Oh, nice.
And I remember seeing him and just falling in love.
Oh, yeah.
and of course, Marion. That.
Yeah.
She had this long, red, curly hair, so I pretended it
was me. That's great.
I remember Sean Connery playing the older Robin.
Yeah, or Errol Flynn. I mean,
Errol Flynn
swinging on a vine up to Marion's window. I was so in love with these stories.
As a child, I had a record, a Children's Guild or something. And from that, from the Robin Hood one, there's a verse about venison, hot bread, and that brown ale. And every once in a while, I just burst out singing that. It just really stuck. But I noticed in the stories you told that there is a lot of feasting and making sure people have food to eat.
Oh,
I mean, it's
yeah.
kind of basic things. And
yeah.
it seems like he's interested in a law that supersedes or is more fundamental than the, the sheriff and the feudal type system. It's a Anyway, I just...
Isn't that interesting?
Think about
yeah, because he's always offering suits of Lincoln green and, you know, all the venison you can eat, a share in the take. I mean, he's like the first guy who was doing the generous giving plan.
It was a co-op.
Yeah. All that you can drink. I think his generosity is what kept the men there as much as anything.
It kept them married.
Yeah, literally.
There's a term, unifying principle. What is that principle around which you gather?
Right.
And his spirit was the unifying principle of the gathering.
I have this little theory, and it was just because it was kind of quirky, that he was the Christ come back in another lifetime to have fun. And that, you know, this was, and that this was just so much more fun. And that he went after the church in a different way. It's like, come on, guys, clean it up. And It was just an opportunity to poke at the system as it was, but to do it in a way that left people really having a good time. Anyway. Yeah, sure.
Is it considered a fairy tale?
Robin?
Yeah.
Not really.
It's a legend.
It's a legend, I think. I'd say it's a myth, but it's actually pretty, I think it's pretty real. I think you find it in Tales of the Day. Yeah.
And the archetype of Robin Hood, are there some other characters in other, maybe than fairy tales where we see the same kind of person or stories that have come about since then where there's a similar archetypical?
That's a good question. Can anyone think of some fairy tales where we have a kind of a doing good hero who's against the local?
I think of the trickster.
Yeah.
The coyote and the
Loki.
Loki.
Coyote.
So the
Batman.
Batman.
Oh.
Ooh. The dark hero. There you go. Right.
Although Robin Hood doesn't seem as dark as in trouble.
That's interesting. You know, I'm thinking of Underdog.
Aunties that,
yeah.
I mean, the Black Panthers. Like, who goes out and maybe steps out of the realm of law abiding.
Right.
But they're doing it in favor of our deep moral.
They're doing it from a good heart place.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was what I found.
So they become heroes even though they are.
I think his playfulness, you know, it made people indignant, but he never killed the Sheriff of Nottingham, so nobody ever needed to come into the forest and kill him and clear him out. You know, if you look at it, he was there for like 40 years. If you look at the tales and read the time period, he was doing this for 40 years. So there's some allowance in the local society that let this continue. Like some sense of maybe he was right. But however long Richard was off in the Crusades. And
yeah, it would have taken away so much if he would have disappeared, right?
Together
such a rich thing for people to be talking about.
He just had this huge tapestry, didn't he? That's amazing.
So what did happen when Richard came back?
When Richard came back, and maybe we'll do this again later with that, but when Richard came back, Robin swore fealty to him immediately. He'd been waiting for him. Yeah, yeah, the whole time. And it was interesting that he just wasn't into the reign of Prince John.
So was he pardoned then?
Oh, yeah, immediately. When Richard came in all the stories that I've read, at least, Richard came in disguise. And Robin didn't know it was him, and he was tested by Richard to see if he was true to the king. And he said he would stand against any man who said anything against the king. Yeah. So he immediately proved his fealty, and so then Richard reveals himself.
So then how did he support himself if he couldn't go around robbing the rich burghers anymore?
He became a landed baron. Yeah,
well,
he was given
lands
by King Richard.
They were taken.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and he became a trusted liegeman at that point. Yeah. So it was worth holding out for all that time. Plus he got Marion. I mean, because King Richard, Marion was in many stories King Richard's ward. And so it wasn't until King Richard came back that he could be given permission to marry her. Yeah, so.
If Richard was gone for 40 years, she must have been pretty old.
Probably wasn't 40. We'll hope for his sake. But remember, he started when Henry was king. So there's a period there of maybe 10 years, 10 to 20. Anyway, I brought a fairy tale along just in case you guys would like one.
Sure.
It's fun and it's short.
Do you want some music for me?
Sure, if you want to. Just make it light. This is a story along the lines of Robin Hood. It's sort of rewriting current politics. Fairy girl meets Sly Fox and the Bandit. once upon a time, in land far, far away, there lived a fairy girl. She lived on a farm near the edge of the woods, and every once in a while, she would enter the woods to play. All of her friends were afraid of the woods and told her not to go there, but she knew the woods were friendly. The trees bent over her on hot days and gave her leafy green shadows to play in. The deer played with her, and the birds would sing to her or ask her questions. One day, while she was playing in the meadow near the edge of the leafy green forest, a sly fox came to the edge of the trees. He wanted to see what she was doing. Edging nearer and nearer, he finally came to her notice. "Hello, fox. What are you doing so near her house?" "Our house," she asked. The sly fox replied, "I came out of the leafy green woods to see what you were doing." The fairy girl answered, "I'm playing a game. Would you like to join me?" "I might want to. However, there's a bandit in the woods who'd like to play with you more than I do," said Sly Fox. "A bandit?" the fairy girl exclaimed, frightened. Her parents had told her to be very afraid of bandits, so she was very frightened of them. "He's a nice guy," the fox said, "if you don't have any money. If you have money, he'll steal it from you. Do you have any money?" "No, I don't have any money," the fairy girl replied. "Then you should be fine playing with the bandit," said Sly Fox. Now, the fairy girl was cautious, but she was also lonely. This time of year, all her friends went to the seashore with their parents, and she was just alone with her family. All she had was the green leafy woods to keep her company. So she went with Sly Fox looking for his friend, the bandit. Mostly, the bandit was a guy who lived in the forest. He grew a garden, kept the cow that gave him milk. Every once in a while, when he needed some money for something truly special, say a new shirt, he'd venture out of the forest and rob people. This didn't happen too often. Eventually, over time, he became friendly with other people living in the village near the woods. He hoped someday to learn a trade so he wouldn't have to rob people anymore. But he wasn't sure how to start learning, so occasionally he would steal from people. Sly Fox introduced the fairy girl to the bandit. She'd heard her mother say that she must never trust people who stole from other people, so she looked doubtful, but asked anyway, "Would you like to play with me?" The bandit had never met a little girl who wanted to play with him before. He liked little children, but he didn't know how to get near them. So he said, "Sure, I'll play with you for a little while. But when it gets time for the sun to go down, you must go home to your mother." "Okay," said the fairy girl. "I should go home before then, probably, anyway. You can help me remember, won't you?" "Sure," said the bandit, winking slyly at the fox. "My friend here will lead you home the speediest way possible, so you won't be late." And the bandit held the fairy girl's hand while they walked into the garden to go play some games. After a little while, the fairy girl said, "It's time to go home. Little fox, will you lead me the speediest way possible?" Now, Sly Fox had never been called Little Fox before. He liked it, so he said, "Sure," and he took her home the quickest way possible. The bandit had other plans when he first met the fairy girl, but he liked her so much, and she was so kind and gentle, he let her go home with the fox. Day after day, the fairy girl came and played with him. After a while, the bandit got up his courage and told her how much he wanted to learn a trade, but didn't know where to begin. The fairy girl looked at him and said, "I know how you can start. My cousin is looking for someone to help him with his garden." "His garden?" the bandit asked. "I know how to garden. Perhaps I can help him and he'll pay me money for it." "I don't know about money," the fairy girl frowned. "He doesn't have a lot of money. But he can give you the wood you need to build the shed you were talking about. I know he has plenty of wood and he might even have some nails." "Oh," the bandit looked thoughtful. "If I had wood and plenty of nails to build the shed I want, then I wouldn't have to steal for money from people to buy it." "That's wonderful," said the fairy girl, clapping happily. "I'm so happy my cousin can help you. I'll ask him tomorrow morning, shall I?" And she looked hopefully at the bandit. "Okay," said the bandit. "You can ask him. Although," he added, "I suppose he'll probably say no." "Oh, no, he'll want to help you. I'll tell him how much I like you, said the fairy girl enthusiastically, and she went off happily towards her home. The next morning, a little later than usual, the bandit was surprised to see the fairy girl coming toward him with a man walking beside her. The man looked a little nervous, but was mostly curious. This is my cousin Mario, said the fairy girl by way of greeting the bandit. He's come to offer you a job. Mario? And she turned to her cousin to introduce him. This is the bandit. And Mario greeted the bandit with a handshake of welcome. The bandit felt something melt inside him, a hard lump of fear that had been near his heart. He returned the handshake of welcome and offered Mario and the fairy girl some fresh milk from his cow. They accepted and enjoyed the milk together while he and Mario talked about the work he could do to help Mario in his garden. Finally, Mario and the fairy girl got up to go. As they were leaving, Mario thanked the bandit for his hospitality and the warm, fresh milk. They smiled at each other, and the bandit said, I'll be over to your farm early tomorrow morning to help. And that was how the fairy girl became friends with Sly Fox and the bandit in the green leafy woods, and how the bandit learned a trade besides robbing people, and how the leafy green trees made a snug, safe place for everyone to live and play in. And that's the happily ever after ending. I'd like to thank Daniel very much for the accompaniment. I told him he was holding my stories together. And if you guys have any questions about the fairy girl or any of the stories we've done tonight. Well, thanks for taking your time tonight.
Is the fairy girl one of your stories?
It's one of mine.
You did write that?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because when I started writing some fairy tales, I was doing it because I was in kind of a tough romantic relationship, and it was scaring the heck out of me, and I thought I'd use fairy tales to just kind of get a sense of reality. As you can tell, if you think about the story, it's like it wasn't a very safe romantic relationship. It's funny because as I looked at my own reasons for writing that story, I started thinking about other people in the fairy tales they were writing, particularly the Brothers Grimm and, you know, Hans Christian Andersen and some of these stories. It's like, what in their life prompted them to write these stories? So that really started me some questions, and that's kind of where I ended up with Robin Hood and Arthur. It's like, how come these stories... Why are they moving through our history? You know, why are they lasting so long? Yeah. Why does Cinderella last so long? What's in that story? You know, it's every girl's story. You know, wanting to suddenly be discovered and become wealthy and have this wonderful, wonderful person who thinks they're adorable. Just, you know, what's the magic in it? So anyway. It made me begin to question the fairy tales that I was reading and want to know more about the story within the story and kind of look at more of our teaching stories with a little more depth. Yeah. Well, thank you all very
much.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Wonderful.
And they put out their wonderful fairy tales
yes,
for you.
Yes, we have a number of fairy tales for you to peruse.